because somewhere in your report you are correctly saying without a capacitated state, we will not achieve the developmental state objectives. Am I quoting you correctly? Now, which means here you say you want a responsive, accountable system, effective and efficient local government. And I think this one, you also, the responsive, it comes also, it flows from the constitution, which is the supreme law of the country. Né? So we would want to know exactly how are you dealing with this effective and efficient local government, because that's such a delivery point. You've got COPTA that is responsible. And today, if you see people protesting, say, it is because at that service delivery point, there's inefficiency, they're ineffective, but as you are the planning and the monitoring and evaluation, I think you would then also assist us here, see, in terms of your monitor and your recommendations, and then also reporting to us on this is how far they have gone with the, you know, implementation of your plan to achieve this. All right, it's the same, but also it's the same on an efficient, effective, and development-oriented public service. It's still about capacity building, skills development to achieve on a developmental state. So we would want to know what is happening here, because if department, for instance, where there's under expenditure, we have found that there's under expenditure because of the ineffective and inefficient service, or let me say implementation of programs by the civil service, the officials. Where there's over expenditure, still talks to this. So we would want to know, as the planning, monitoring and evaluation department within the presidency, how are you assisting to achieve this? Now it's midterm, we're still complaining about the same problems. Wasteful expenditure, fruitless expenditure, because of people who are not doing their work effectively and efficiently. So I was just trying to, it's a follow-up on the other outcome that you've spoken to, né? And then you said you left them out because you submitted this to cabinet. Cabinet has accepted this. So I wanted to say to you, you remember in terms of separation of powers, it's true, cabinet has got the right, but we also have the things that we're looking at to assist this government to deliver on their promises. Okay, and then on page 13, there's still another illustration. Okay, where I'm talking about the narrative, there must be follow through on decisions made by cabinet. Evaluation and monitoring and evaluation. So this is the story. You're telling us a story. You're not telling us what you have found and what you know, impact it has made, and then this is what you have recommended. You're telling us there must be. We know. This is exactly what we know. So we're looking at whether that is happening or not happening. So in your case, because you're doing work on a quarterly basis, you're supposed to say, even when you say deploy resources, see here, you're going to help us big time, Dot. Yes. You say, we must sharpen focus and deploy resources to priority areas. Now, if you were specific here and factual here, we were going to be assisted, because we were going to say, okay, yeah, this is the area where we think we must look at, and then recommend amendments so that money can go to this area and this area and this area. But now it's vague. This one, you're going to assist us big time. That's what we're looking for. You telling us, no, yes, but the priorities are this. And in terms of the budget allocation, this is where it's skewed. And we think if money can be put here and here and here, can you hear? Does it make sense, Doctor? You say, yeah, you're going to help us big time. Because, Chinna, we're coming here with, there are things that we're looking for. And we don't find those things. That's why we're getting frustrated. This one is very, very, it's practical, more practical. That's what we were looking for. There must be follow-through on decisions made by cabinet. All that we expect, quality decisions, quality and sustainable decisions. Somebody said, looks like you sleep and change your decisions. No, it doesn't work like that, not in government. Doesn't work like that. You take quality decisions, it means those decisions will be informed and by researchers. Researchers must do their work. And then when the decisions are taken, there will be quality and sustainable decisions. And then you focus on the actual implementation, not to be talking about follow up on the decisions made. What do you want? Monitoring? How far have you gone with the actual implementation of those decisions? And what are you recommending? All right? Must be accountability for poor performance. You telling us? We know that. But as people are doing monitoring and evaluation, what is the magnitude of the problem and what is being done to address that, and what are the bottlenecks? We know this. You know, every day when we meet these departments, we tell them, I said, there's no consequence management. But planning, monitoring, and evaluation, they come and tell us the same thing. Can you see it's not helping us? We know about this, but we want to know now, in terms of accountability for poor performance, how far have we gone in ensuring that there's improvement in this area, and then what are the bottlenecks? Does it make sense? Does it make sense? Okay. Yeah, now maybe it's for the first time that we meet. I take it that maybe in the next meeting you will now know what is it that we're looking for. We don't want a narrative. We want these are the facts, and then we've gone so far, and then this is what we have done. Because you can recommend. And then when we meet with those departments, because we'll be knowing which department, and then we focus on those areas and say, okay, fine. Here, you got a report from, just like National Treasure. They analyze, they send back to the department, and then we ask, how far have you gone with the implementation of this? Because it was going to make this impact. Yes, okay, like that. And when I say narrative, Bobabe, because you all males, maybe I should have said Bobaba. Okay. You're telling us the capacity of the state, the heart of radical economic transformation, you're telling us, is an effective state that is decisive in its pursuit of structural change. What is monitoring here? What have you monitored here? And what, that's why I say narrative. Now you understand. Say, no, you're telling us what is, no, we want to find out in your monitoring and evaluation, what have you found? How far have we gone here? What are the bottlenecks? And what have you recommended? All right. To me, it's just a follow-up. At least now you know we follow money, so we want to set, and then value for money, which is your impact. Follow money, value for money, and also we must amend. We must recommend an amendment, but it must be so informed that people must not think we are personal, because we will then be able to say, in terms of the recommendation, because people want to know, what's your source? We must then say planning and evaluation report. We must list our, otherwise that thing will not be reliable. Any recommendation to amend without our sources and reliable sources. Okay, all right, thanks. Then the honourable member, Obasa, thereafter we hand over. Sorry, I forgot to mention.
Let me just make this brief observation that, the things that we are saying all over again stem from what Honorable Sinokwanyana raised right at the beginning of the question session, where she said, give us concrete achievements up to this far that tell us we are moving towards the attainment of the NDP goals. and we keep on repeating this in various forms. So I hope that we are getting through to you. I just have specific things to raise, you know, and which probably are part of the homework that we are talking about. The NEF on page, what's this thing? Page 11. And I assume you are talking about the National Empowerment Fund, which recently was reported to be requiring recapitalization. The last time I checked, the IDC was going to come to its rescue. If you could go check that, because I raise this issue because its sole mandate is funding of black-owned companies. And if you don't recapitalize that institution, you are killing the black-owned, the process of funding the black-owned companies. Please go check that. You know, for the past 7.5 years, we've been talking about beneficiation. Can we have an assessment of how far have we gone? Probably DTI will tell this story to you, and you can give it back to us. Because it doesn't look like we are making great progress there. So that's the second homework. Skilled and professional public service. We've had Palama, we've had the academy launched in the public service and administration. What have these achieved in terms of moving towards a skilled and capable public service? And that links up with what Honorable McLachlan was saying earlier on, that if people don't sign performance contracts, it does not matter how much we skill them, they are not going to perform. So let's assess how far have we built skills there. The last thing that I would like us to check is, Honorable McLachlan says something very important, to say that if you own shares in the stock exchange, that's not ownership of the economy. Our understanding of ownership of the economy is ownership, control and management of firms, like companies. It will not serve us to pat our backs on what former Minister of Finance Trevor Manuel said, where individuals buying shares and then going to play golf. That's not manufacturing. So we would be interested in knowing the actual companies owned by black people listed in the stock exchange. That's one part of it. The second part of that is the issue that you raised about the externalization of South African firms through all sorts of things, listing and mergers and acquisitions and what have you, which contributes to the expatriation of South African money, which otherwise would have contributed to South Africa's GDP. How much of that has now happened? Because we keep on saying the economy is not growing, the GDP, this, that, and the next thing, government is failing, blah, blah, blah. We don't assess the effects of the externalization of South African firms and the expatriation of South African money in various forms. So, where do we stand? And what effect does that have on the economy? And what needs to be done to correct that situation? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Yes, Over to you, Doctor. Okay. Oh, but just wait. I just want to find out from PBO. Do you have anything to contribute or to add or to subtract? We are fine. All right. Thank you very much. Over to you.
Chair. Chair, I think maybe it's the way we craft our message, and I feel the unhappiness around it. I mean, we are clear. We thought that we were clear that basically the three levers of the NDP, we are way behind in terms of meeting them. This is the issue of dropping poverty to zero. We are very far from it. The creation of the 11 million jobs that is required, we are far from it.
Percentage? What percentage? A breakdown. What percentage? Actually, I'm opening that page. I was saying, I kept talking, we're talking too much. I was looking at it to say, if you say 39% of people living below poverty line to zero.
Yeah.
Now, your department, that's my thinking, you will correct me, because we look at the same thing from different angle. From 2014 to 2019, in your plan, you would have said, 2014, we achieved so much, and then so that come, it is part of that 39%. You break it down. Actually, you can even break it down to 2030 so that you can arrive, and this is what is doable within the 5 years. Then you focus on implementation of that thing that is doable within the 5 years. Because the 39% is up till 2030, am I right?
Yes.
You see? So yours, in your planning stage, you break it down and make it implement, because a plan must be smart. It must be implementable, must be measurable. So in your plan, because you are planning, then within the 5 years, you would have planned that this year, you achieve so much this year, and then you would then be able to say, no, of the 5 years that, we have done
this much,
2% or 3%. So we don't even know 39%.
Yeah.
What,
so,
sorry?
What you're saying is very significant, Chair. If we could get this in writing, a report on what we're supposed to achieve for up to 2019, what we have achieved annually, and also the reasons why, what do you believe the reasons are that why we're not achieving it, and what do you perhaps think we can do
next?
To correct it? Yes, thank you.
Same, reduce unemployment rate to 6% by 2030. Even this one, same approach in the 5 years, because we're talking medium-term strategic framework. So we can't be talking 6%, we must talk your own percent as a contribution towards this 6% by 2030.
Yes, Chair, so what I was saying is that maybe it's in our packaging, and what I was going to propose is that we offer you where are we in terms of these big ideas of where the NDP wants to take us, to say, this is where we were in 2014, this is where we are, and these are the reasons why we have not reached those.
Yeah.
And then in that way, you'll be able to see the progress that we have made.
Yes, sir.
And then on addition to that, I am proposing to you, Chair, that we also provide for the 14 outcomes so that you know for each outcome. That means everyone who comes here, you'll be able to say,
exactly,
this is what you are supposed to achieve, but according to this, these are the rates. So we'll give you with the reds and the yellow that we are always providing. Then you'll be able to see for the 14 outcomes what are the challenges, and where have we succeeded and where are we failing. Some of the reasons why, Chair, we ended up not doing this, besides what Rudy has said, is that sometimes when we give people this, they like, it's too much information that you've given us. Where can you tell us one or two things that really changes? So we are, that's what we've been guided in doing this, and I'm saying as our homework and to bring back this to you is we will provide the 14 outcomes with that information, and then on top of that we will also say, since it's around it's more than 200 indicators, we will select a few that we say if you focus on this, they have a higher probability of really unblocking those bottlenecks that we are seeing, so that you are much more empowered to ask the tough questions that we have not sometimes been able to push people, because people push back sometimes when we are requesting things. And I'm, so as a homework, we'll be able to do that. Just a few things, and then Rudy can talk. On the local government, we have your LG MIM, which is basically evaluating the management of your local government. We also are continuously monitoring how these municipalities are improving the way they govern themselves and manage themselves. We have every year a table that basically tells them where their weaknesses are, and it gives them what they need to do. Then secondly, we are also involved in the back to basics process, where we've taken a few of these municipalities and we are working with them to say these are the things that you need to do. It's a pilot that we are running. Unfortunately, it's not for the whole country, because we'll understand this problem, you need to move as a pilot to understand what are the challenges. So maybe what we need to do is that as part of that package is to say what have we done with the local government in terms of our evaluation, and where are we and what are the challenges that we have seen with them. And then the other issues are difficult ones to deal with, like the political will, because we have systems. We know that certain things have to be done. I mean, we've been trying to encourage departments to actually do those the things that they need to do. For example, the 30-day payments, that we know that the small businesses are dying because departments are not responding to the 30-day the requirement to pay within 30 days. We have a report on what we have recovered by our direct intervention when these companies are complaining. But we are saying that's not the right way of doing things, because that is only us intervening that things get done. You need to set up a system where the departments are actually responsive and able to do this without the intervention of the presidency itself. And so we can also provide to say these are the emerging trends that we are finding in terms of the local government and also national departments, which are those things that they are not paying. I agree with the issue of the that there are some that are there's more corruption that is happening around those 500 tenders that you just need to call a few people, and it's something that we may need to be able to look at in the future on saying how do we curb it, and what kinds of systems are actually can help us, considering that there are those provinces that are actually doing well around these issues. So what is it that they have put in place, and what is working? I don't know how to say it. I think with the agriculture issue, I think we can come back with the allegations themselves. What are these allegations that we are talking about, so that you know what has been found by the officials who are working in that sector. Rudy?
Okay.
Well, may quickly, Honourable Chair, on the premium, on the price premium, Honourable Member, I think what the Department of Rural Development and Land Affairs have set up is an office of the evaluated danger. And I think for us, it's simply not paying in excess amounts of what the market price has been, given the current system that we have. If the constitution, of course, changes, or whatever changes, then of course there's a different system. But I think it's the overpricing
beyond market prices, right, on land and availability of land that becomes a problem, and that's what we refer to in terms of premium pricing. Honorable Imam has left, but we can have a long debate around the importance of grants. So maybe just to correct him, there are 11 million child recipients of the CSG, not 17. 17 million people in total get grants. So 11 million, which is the biggest component of the CSG. John will tell you there's been immense amount of studies on the impact of the CSG, and I don't necessarily agree with Honorable Imam that, I think my point early on was that we want to get full employment. But the CSG has been critically important, particularly when the recipient of the grant is the mother, right? And women tend to use the grant for the purposes of its intention, to meet food needs, to help in education, and some of them in some of the studies actually show that they use the grants to seek employment. That's very, very critical. Contrast to some of the fathers who don't use it for that purpose. I won't say what they do, right? But it's important to show that the CSG is an important contributor towards not only meeting basic needs and addressing poverty, but also as an employment contributor. So they do job search. I mean, some of the studies actually show that they use the money to then look for employment. And I think there's a value for the CSG grants, and particularly the social grants in a whole list of different things. But that's a different debate altogether. The same debate around inclusive growth. Honorable Fik, I mean, during the boom period, we had lots of growth, right? We've not necessarily... I mean, there's quite an interesting number of literature that has come up, even from the World Bank and the IMF, on growth in itself. Growth is not an end in itself. But the challenge that we're sitting globally, and it's not a phenomenon to South Africa, is that growth happens, but hasn't been inclusive enough. And so we lack the ability to make it much more inclusive, and it's why, for example, the debate is raging about how unequal society has gotten, not only in South Africa, but all over. And there's a focus on saying, what is it that we need to do to make growth much more inclusive? So we went through a particular boom in South Africa, the mining commodity boom, between 2000 and 2008. And the question is, and this is what we're trying to analyze, is that, you know, yes, there's been some, you know, increase in employment, there's been significant growth in that, but has it been inclusive enough? And we don't think so. And so we need to have that debate that says, so what makes it much more inclusive? Growth is important. You know, I mean, interesting, someone had said that, you know, you talk about inclusive growth, but we can't even achieve growth, so how can you talk about inclusive growth? But it's very, very important, because growth, the inability to have inclusive growth has been shown to inhibit growth itself. You know, so you have the inability, so if it's not inclusive or not, it can actually stop us from growing. And there's various studies that have shown that that is an inhibitor. So we have to talk about inclusive growth. We must define for us what we mean as inclusive growth. And we thought that some of the areas that we look at would have to do with that. On the NDP, we hear Honorable Chair, and Dr. Mabogani has agreed that we'll do that. On the Jobs Fund, Honorable Member, we're able to report on the progress on the Jobs Fund as it is right now. We can provide a response to assess. We have done an assessment of the Jobs Fund and some of the projects. Ownership and control, yes, I agree with both Honorable McLaughlin and Honorable Obasi, that the JSE is a useful proxy. Think of it as that. Now it's about looking at the broad ownership and control in the economy, because the JSE is one proxy of that kind of ownership. But the JSE is fairly large. I'm not sure whether honorable members have seen more recently, there's an article, how JSE is the 14th largest in the world. So that's quite significant. You know, we have assets of just under a trillion today, under a trillion US dollars. So that's quite competitive. Not only that, our returns on equity is one of the best in the world. So you have a significant number of people flocking in, and that's why we have that shift in foreign. But it's a good proxy, and I think I agree with honorable members that JSE is only one component, but it is quite a large component. And if you And we can measure it. If we can get it right, we can measure it. And it will give us a sense of what happens in the rest of the economy, and I think that would be important. So I just wanted to say that one. On the mining, I think Honorable Member just left right now. Underperforming, yes, it's... Though mining as a share of GDP has reduced quite significantly from its heyday, right? Mining as percentage of GDP are somewhere between 7% and 8%. Mining is still our largest export earner. So of our total value of exports earned, mining is more than 50% of that. So while it shrunk in terms of both employment and contribution to GDP, it's still an important export earner. And therefore what happens in the export market, in the external market, has a significant impact on the economy. So we put that point there not because there were other factors, but because a decline in commodity exports, coal, manganese, platinum, has had a significant impact on the economy. But there are other factors. I must say, let's be honest, honorable members, there are other factors like confidence, investor confidence. Right? So if we take decisions that are not consistent decisions in what we say, or there are conflicting messages that we put out, this has a significant impact on decisions for investments and foreign direct investment, even localized investment. So these are factors. Access to capital is also another factor. And of course, because of the kind of global slowdown, and the availability of capital has had a significant impact on investment, particularly by state-owned enterprises. So what you've seen, if you look at investment as a percentage of GDP, what you have seen is both decline in terms of private sector investment and decline by the state sector, and that's specifically by SOCs. So SOCs are also cutting back. So Transnet is cutting back on its investments because there's no opportunity for making significant profits because private sector is cutting back. You have cutting back by the NEL, you have cutting back by ESCOM, for example, also. And that all has a multiplier effect on the rest of the economy, because private sector is also not purchasing, for example, more energy. So we've just recently seen that the amount of energy purchases by the private sector has significantly declined, so much so that it's the lowest relative to many other years. And I think that's... Honorable Ngobasi. I thought that the NEF thing... It's a debate, Honorable Ngobasi. I can't give you an answer, but I think there's options that are being considered, as I understand. I have not been part of the debate, but I've been following it, that there is a possibility of the NEF being absorbed into the IDC. So the problem with the NEF is that it's as a significant impaired loan book. Right? So unlike other DFIs, they've not been able to recuperate a significant component of the loans that have gone out to many of the businesses, and that's why it's operating there. I think there are various options that are being considered, whether it's going to be recapitalized or whether it's going to be absorbed. One of the problems with the DFIs is that we think, and we've said this, Honorable Chair, we are implementing it right now. This is one of the things that we're implementing. We don't think the DFIs and SOCs are adequately aligned to the objectives of the NDP, and that's the problem. So we need to measure. So we need to measure ownership. So if you look at DFIs, where does your money go to? How much goes to young people? How many goes to SMEs? Which sectors in the economy are you looking at? Because if it's the wrong sectors and it's not having the kind of employment growth, then we need to look at something else. The amount of women that you... So we need to look at those kind of measurements that are very, very critical. And we bring in SOCs as part of our responsibility. We bring in SOCs and DFIs better aligned to the NDP, and when they report, that report is aligned with us. And I think this is one of the challenges that we have, not only for the NEF, but also for other DFIs on the Bumbashi. And then, of course, the ownership of the economy, I did mention. I think that's a useful proxy. I don't think it's an absolute kind of measurement, but it is huge, and I think it's important that we do look at that, because that's where the big chunk of all our money goes. Our equity is coming. When there's a shortfall in savings, and we need to meet the kind of current account, the deficits, it's the reliance on equities that come. And I agree with you that we need to understand the impact of this. I don't think we've adequately measured the impact. So, for example, we may want to look at the impact of what has happened in terms of political changes. But we need to look at it and say, honestly, has it had a significant impact on the rand? What does the rand mean in terms of export cost, fuel cost, for instance? And what does it mean for exports? What does it also mean for flows? You know, both DFIs and flows into our bond market and to our, into our equities. And we need to look at the decisions that we take and what impact it has to be able to see what it does. But it is a scary picture, I must say. I mean, when one looks at the foreign inflows of capital, it is an extremely scary picture because it's our over-reliance on foreign inflows to meet our shortfall in savings is going to be a significant challenge. And decisions that we take have an impact on whether people not buy bonds and sell off our bonds, or suddenly decide to disinvest from the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. And that would have a significant repercussion for us, and I think that's something that we need to look at. It's part of the debate, and when honourable members ask what do we mean by structural changes, that's the structural change that we talk about. The structural changes is significant changes in the way that we see our economy. We need to see where are the areas that we need to grow our economy. And the structural changes that we refer to in the slide is how do we grow manufacturing? How do we grow mining and mining beneficiation, and how do we ensure that the supply chains for mining, both upstream and downstream, you know, so there's significant contributions, although mining is small, but it's huge in terms of value, right? And so that's what we have to look at. So our over-dependence on mining and our export markets, as I said, 50% of the value of exports earned comes still from mining. How do we diversify our export baskets from manufacturing? How do we export and ensure that services that has grown significantly so in our economy moves into other areas of our economy, into more rural areas, but also into the north of Africa, you know, so that we're able to do that. That's the structural changes that we have. How do we ensure that we deal with the kind of inefficiency in the banking sector where four banks control literally almost everything, right? In terms of, and we have to have those debates. Those are very difficult debates, honorable members. But we have to talk about the structural change that can grow the economy. And the structural change that currently, the current situation is one that is not providing the kind of growth, employment, and reducing inequality. And we have to have those difficult decisions. And some of those difficult decisions are the decisions that are not in the interest of capital, right? Some of the decisions may not also be in the interest of workers, but I think those discussions have to have in order for us to make those kind of structural shifts in the broad economy so that we can see. Because the only way we can deal with the kind of challenges that we have is if we create more and more jobs, and we're not creating that number of jobs that we have.
Okay. No, thank you so much. I think it is an interesting engagement. Our enemy is time. It is time. We would have loved to go on and on and on this particular presentation, but then time is not on our side. We need to take a lunch break and then come back again, proceed with the other presentation. I don't know whether it's a recommendation or what that I want to give you. On the resolve these issues, you're saying resolve these issues, but we know that there's a commission that is working on that. And then you then say convene a summit to reach consensus. But there's a commission already that is being paid. There's money that is being used there to find a suitable way of paying or of funding education. But you still say we must go to summit. Another money will be used there. Instead of us waiting for the outcome, and then, for instance, in your report, I'm just mentioning it in passing, you would say, and the president has appointed a commission, and you will be knowing which date he'll be presenting the report. And thereafter, that report, the way I see it here, because instead of holding a summit, maybe you'd have to do some public hearings on that report so that to get consensus. And, am I right? Yeah. You see, so, but yours is a step before the commission. That's what you're telling us. But we know now, presently, this is what is happening. You're still telling us that we must resolve the issues, but the president is busy resolving the issues. Okay, but I don't. Yes, Rob. This one is a 2016 report, man.
No.
That's right.
No, no,
Chair.
I'm telling you.
Because.
Why are you talking before 2016? I mean, I'm telling you, this thing was done 2016.
No, Chair, because
2015.
even no.
2015, yes, it was 2015.
No, Chair, because even...
The appointment was 2015.
No, the commission is there. When they give us the report, that mean, does not mean the state has to implement that report.
Yeah, your report will be saying, because you are monitoring.
Yes.
The commission has been to look into this matter. Now, that's where we are. Not to say, find a way of dealing with these issues. There's already a way. But how far have we gone with the implementation of that decision?
Okay,
it's fine.
Okay.
It's okay. Let's not debate it. But I'm trying to show you that you're giving us information. We want now, and we want to move forward to the 2019. So at least you'll help us. Now you know what we want. Né? In future, you will know what we want. So otherwise, honorable members, I think I know that we would have, I can see from your eyes that you would have loved to go on and on, but due to time constraints, can I then be allowed that we then stop this discussion here and take a lunch break, and then, which I think because we are already, you know, we already 10 to 2, maybe quarter past 2, 30 minutes break. Would that be okay? Better than nothing. Every bread is better than no, you know, no at all, you know? Okay. So shall we take a lunch break and then we come back at quarter past 2? Thank you very much. Yeah, the lunch break, there's lunch served there. So we can have it here. Yeah, we're here.
How are you, sir? How are you doing? Are you liking it?
You must give us my initial fight. I have a long sentence.
Yeah, I need your phone. Don't you guys need a setup in your organization? I'm very qualified. I'm looking for a position in the multinational organization.
Well, what we are doing now is we are using the lecture, so we don't know the process, how it's going to be. So maybe so what you can do is to find out, I think maybe May, June, you would have done that challenge and check whether they are have they created a position. Yeah. Because I know that there is a new research unit. So I don't know where they are people, where they are putting from other departments. So if you maybe stop the back, just send me an email and say, I'm just checking where I can find the tariff. But I know that there's a new session.
And you're based in Dublin, right?
Yeah,
sorry, it's on Pretoria. Do you have like another the presentation? I don't have it, the one you just
made. I just had it in the email. I think so.
Okay.
Because I just go to the just reference to the yes.
Weekend. I some issues.
All right.
Thank you. The long day.
Thank you.
Honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, shall we settle down so that we can proceed with the business of the meeting? Well, we are now on after lunch break. We will be receiving a presentation by the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation on the alignment between the budget priorities and the medium-term strategic framework and the National Development Plan. So that alignment is key. We want to see if we are achieving on that and where can we put pressure for acceleration of the implementation so that come 2019, there's no outstanding work from this strategic framework. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Earlier we were given two presentations. One was the updated one. I just want to know, how do I tell the two apart? How do I know which one is the updated one?
The updated one has got page numbers.
Updated one is there. This one, Kialebo. I just want to check if we all have the updated presentation. Because I don't, but I'll be getting one soon. The one with numbers. Is it this one? Is it the updated one?
It's got page numbers.
No, this one does not have numbers.
Small page numbers at the bottom.
All right, so we all have the presentation, am I right? This one, but it is numbered. The difference is that this one is numbered, the updated one. Can you please indicate by show of hand if you don't have, so that, okay. Honorable Member Manana does not have. Request the department to take us through the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity. I think I'm going to take the liberty to give a short narrative before I dive into the... because I think sometimes the key part of the story gets lost in all the numbers and so on. So I think there's three points that we want to make. I think, we welcome being called here to talk about this alignment, because our minister has been pressurizing, and also the National Planning Commission has been pressurizing us a lot on this alignment issue, saying that, we think that the budget might not be aligned to the plan. Look at it, tell us what you think. And they haven't been easy on us, they've been pushing us, we haven't got far enough, but just to say that this is an important issue that we've been busy with. I think about, you mustn't tell your story too quickly, but, I think the number of letters that we are saying here, that at a broad level, if we look at the NDP levers and we look at the budget function groups, it looks as if the NDP is funded. So we push money broadly in the right directions. So in one sense, it looks okay, but then, of course, the question comes, but if we spend on the right things, why don't we get the impact we want? Why don't we hit the poverty targets? Why don't we hit... So I think that's a sort of a two-legged conclusion. Broadly things look okay, but clearly there's something deeper we want to look at. And I think then the third point is that this alignment cannot be a once-off task, you know. So every year we get better at figuring, yes, we had that in place, we did spend on basic education, but we didn't hit the targets properly, so where do we need to adjust? So I think this is it's a really a journey. We're going, getting better information, and really the annual budget process is partly about that, but Cabinet has now also pushed and said, before the budget process, we want a stronger prioritization process that looks at this alignment. So it is a process that is ongoing and that we're busy with now, so we are still sort of reading the tea leaves of the last budget and so on. So these are our final questions, and I think we have to agree with each other that this is a very important job, and, you know, we're pushing it forward every year as well as we can. So what I want to talk about is just basically bring you to the issue of the budget and economic transformation, which was, so that is just really a summary of the state of the nation, in a sense. Then I think if we talk about alignment, we know what need to know what we're aligning to, what are the priorities. So there's a bit of a setting out of how we see the priorities in the NDP and the levers really related to that. And then lastly, looking at the alignment in terms of the broad numbers, but then also the alignment in terms of impact and what the key areas are that we are looking at. And then there are some preliminary conclusions on areas where alignment can be improved. Basically, how the presentation works is there's some text that generally explain the picture that follows after that. So I'm going to mostly stick to the picture. So the first one is slide number 4. And that is, as I said, basically a summary of the State of the Nation address on economic transformation. The point has been made before that more than 20 years after democracy, we're still sitting with these unequal and low incomes, skewed property ownership, the concentrated ownership of firms, and the domination of white male management. And the State of the Nation then went into explaining that we need this economic emancipation, and it looked at the different levers. So it looked at legislation, licensing, but specifically also it quoted the budget and procurement reform as one of the key levers that we need to use to change the situation. It then went also into a lot of detailed examples, such as what we've got there, the subcontracting of the 30%, the land reform and restitution, the access to university. So it gave a lot of examples of what government is already doing in these areas to transform. But I think the basic point of this slide is, as you have confirmed, and as the SONA confirmed, that the budget is one of the key levers we have to effect this change. The second set of pictures then talk to the NDP priorities, and I think the way it's presenting here is that there are two really apex priorities. The first one is about poverty or prosperity. That is about getting poverty down from 39% to zero. So 39% people poor in 2011 was about 20 million people. The NDP says in 2030 we want no people poor. So that is quite radical and dramatic also in terms of equality, wants to see a significant decline in inequality. And really the key intermediate objective, it's very difficult to just take away poverty, you've got to give people jobs and incomes to do that. So we see really the intermediate objective of the NDP as these jobs and incomes that we're going to create, and you've heard it before, by 2030 the NDP says 11 million additional jobs, which would then need about 5.5%, 5.4% per year growth. So clearly if we talk about alignment, it's not just enough to look at these targets and intermediate objectives. We're now going to look at what the NDP says, how are we going to get that. And as Thabo has previously said, there are the three levers really that the NDP talks about. The strong economy, citizens with capabilities, healthy, skilled citizens, and then also a capable state, a state that works well. So that is summarized really on page 26 of the NDP, these three broad levers that we have. Now those really correspond, these levers or pillars really correspond to what we can call three big budget function groups. So if we look at our budget, it is possible to add it up in terms of economic services on the one hand, administrative services, and then also the social services. So what we say here, the budget really dovetails with the NDP here. The budget has got three broad categories of spending that we can get from it, and those are also the areas in the NDP. So the question then next is to, on the economic services, on the administrative services, and for this summary we include justice and policing under administrative services. We've got those three broad groups, those three levers that government can use in its budget to affect jobs and incomes and poverty, and then how is government using its resources in terms of those areas. So I'm coming to the first question that we then ask about really alignment, and it takes the three pillars of the NDP, the economic services, the government and admin, and the social services, and it looks at the different numbers. Sorry, this is a bit hazy there. But as you can then see, economic services takes about, in the 2017-18 budget, economic services take about 515 billion, or 33% of the budget. Administrative and protection services, 269 billion, or 17%, and social services, 610 billion, or 39%. So that's the broad area, and I think where people normally start in the first place, a lot of these social services are constitutionally mandated to provide social security to South Africans, education and so on. So a first measure of alignment is that, yes, government is spending significantly on these constitutional functions, but we also then see the important economic services, and we include higher education and post-secondary education and training in the economic services. There are also then a significant spending targeting strengthening of the economy. I think what comes up more and more as well is the debt service cost here at 162 billion, and that has been increasing quite strongly, so that now again takes 10% of our budget. So this is a very high level picture that we can do some things. The areas where spending is most redistributed, the social services get the biggest part, which is also some of our key constitutional mandates, but certainly in terms of this high level area, there's a huge amount being spent on also creating the conditions for our businesses to grow. And then in terms of a capable state and protection services, also 17% of the budget. Clearly this is very high level, so the members would not be happy with that, but we break it down then a bit further to say then, if we look at what Treasury calls the function groups, these function groups within these different broader levers, one can see the allocations there, and clearly the largest allocation in our budget, and I'm leaving out debt service here, goes to basic education at the bottom, 16% of the budget to basic education. The next important one, biggest one, is economic affairs, which goes to DTI and so on. DTI, science and technology, and so on. That's about 14% of the budget. So once again, of course, one can interrogate these things in more detail, but one can see that there is a good balance in many ways between the social services, but also spending on the areas that more directly supports the economy. And then general public services takes about 5% of the cake, 71 billion. So it's a large amount of money, but not the lion's share of the budget. So that's the first way of looking at this alignment issue, is just the different proportions. We'll also come and look at it more in terms of the growth. So that's just the situation into 2017-18. The next slide, then slide 13, looks at the trends in these numbers. So firstly, it just looks at the high level. Again, economic services, social services, administrative services, and debt. And you can see what has been happening in real terms over the last 7 years. So from 2013-14 to 16-17, we see that there's been 2.3% real growth in expenditure. So while departments have been complaining and there's a lot of talk about things being not funded adequately. There's actually been real growth still in the budget over the last 3 years to the tune of 2.3%. It differs between those different areas. The strongest growth was in the economic cluster, mostly because, as we'll see, as a result of this increased spending on higher education. Social spending also increased by nearly 2% per year in real terms, and administrative services by 1%. But we can see clearly that the debt is something that is making our life more difficult, that is eating more, that's been growing at 6.9% per year over the last 3 years. Going forward, we see that most of the areas still grow in real terms. So in the budget that we've got in the 2017-18 budget, going up to 2018-19, economic services continue to grow by about 1.5% in real terms above inflation, social by 1.9%, and administrative services, which include protection services, start declining. So that is where the pressures are starting to mount on central departments, like ourselves, and also central departments and provinces and so on. So with the restraint, with a slower growth and the slower growth in revenues, there's been a need to slow down the expenditure growth on administrative services. So I think this tells us again that there is still real growth in the budgets, but it is definitely slowing, and in some areas it's becoming negative. Once again, in terms of this real change, we can look at, I don't know whether that's big enough for members to see, but
they have the slide.
You have the slide, so that is on page 14. So here we see in the period 2016 to 17, we know that there was overall growth in both periods, but there's especially one area where there's been negative growth over both the periods, and that is in agriculture, rural development, and land reform. So a decline there of 2.5% per year, and then also going forward it is declining. And in our discussions with the National Planning Commission, people have been quite unhappy about that, because also the issue of land was raised. So I haven't got the detailed answers why the slowdown, but that is clearly something that we have to look in at more detail. We also see that in the first period, 2016 to 17, your defense and public order declined in real terms, very small, so they more or less kept their budget. There was a slight real decline, but we can see that they have got real pressures in terms of paying their salaries at this stage, and so on, because there's been quite a limit on that budget. Going forward then, 2019-20, over the next 3 years, we also see again the total positive growth, real growth, and the two that decline over that second period is again agricultural, rural development, and land, and the general public service. So DPME, DPSA, National Treasury, DCOC, those budgets are being squeezed. So you shouldn't ask us to do too much extra, but that's what's happening there. So I think once again we see the issue that in an economy that grows very slowly, this growing debt service cost is becoming more of a problem as it squeezes out other things. So that's about the change. I think another way of looking at this is just to look at not at the change per year. So what we've got, these percentages talk to the different categories as a proportion of the total. So here we see that most of the three big categories of spending decline. So economic services goes from 33.2 of the total to 32.5. Social from 39.4 to 38.9. And admin declines the most strongly in relative terms, from 18.6% of the budget to 16.6% of the budget. So we see really that the things we spend on, they get smaller relative to the debt, which has gone from 8.8% in 2013-14, and it's expected to reach about 11%. So I think it again reflects our significant dilemma that we've got an economy that's growing very slowly, We've been borrowing for some time, and now we have to repay, and that repayment is now becoming a bigger proportion of our budget. So it's really putting the squeeze on budgets. So in this context, it is very difficult to spend on new priorities. This slide just gives it also the proportions of the total in a bit more detail. So the highlight is that the proportional decline is again true for all functional groups except post-secondary education and training. You'll see there it went from 4.2% of the budget to 5% it is expected to go. So if we talk about what have we prioritized going forward, it is really post-secondary education and training, and then that also lifts the economic services. Health is going up very slightly, and also human settlements and municipal infrastructure increases its share. So from one perspective, we can say those are the three areas, if we look at the actual budget, that is going up. We see that social protection there towards the middle, it declined over the period to 2016-17 as a proportion of the total, but then picked up to its 2013-14 level. It's expected to pick up again up to 2019-20. So I think this just gives some summary measures of what the things are that in a very limited budget are being prioritized, and I think the questions we've got to ask, is there something very big wrong there? So as I said earlier in the beginning, you know, our sense is in terms of the broad areas that we spend on and how that's been changing, except perhaps for agricultural, rural development and land, most people wouldn't find too much fault. Of course, if we had a lot more money, it would have been good and we could have added a lot to areas. But in terms of these broad balances between the sectors, perhaps things look broadly okay. But of course, that's not good enough, because if this is okay, why aren't we seeing the impact? So this was my conclusion on these numbers. In spite of slow economic growth, most spending areas are still growing slightly in real terms. So if people tell Treasury we've got an austerity budget, Treasury says UK is an austerity budget. Their real expenditure is actually coming down. Departments have got less. South African departments, there are some who've got less, not just the central administration over there, but most departments have still got some real growth. The cost might be going up a lot as well, but as I said, PSET is showing the strongest real growth and increase in relative importance, and we can talk more about that a bit later. There are significant cuts now coming in general public services, and we just say, well, you know, so this is one picture, but we need to look at it in more detail. So if we look at the outcomes and alignment, and I'm skipping the text and going to the picture, so I think this is partly what commissioners, I work with the commissioners of the MPC a lot, so sorry, members, but this is a picture. If we look at progress 2010 to 15, the target, we said there was a total target of 11 million jobs up to 2030. If we take the target by 2015, it should have been 2.8 million jobs. We actually got to 2 million jobs. So we created just more than 2 million jobs in that period. So it's not that far short, but if you look at the unemployment rate, we wanted the unemployment rate actually to decline, but it went up in spite of job creation. And the reason for that is basically that our labor force is growing faster, you know, so we underestimated in the NDP, the labor force growth, the population and the labor force growth. So at least some jobs, but not fast enough. We said 5.4% growth per year. We've actually, up to 2015, we've made 2.1% per year. And people would know that in 2016, really we've got close to negative growth overall. It was 0.8%. Yeah. But it brought down this average. So as I said, I mean, if we look at poverty and we break up these targets, by 2015, we should have gone down from 39% to 27%. I am awaiting those figures from Stats SA. They don't want to sort of give us information before they're releasing their living conditions survey data in May. And equality, we should have been at 0.66 a Gini. But on both these indicators, most of us think that there wouldn't have been much headway between 2011 and 2015. The economic growth has just been too slow. So this is the point, you know, this is now what we're asking. So how do we align not only with the leaders, but also to make sure we make a difference here? And just perhaps a bit of background on strengthening alignment. I think strengthening alignment is also not something that we've been working on only the last year. I think really over the last two decades there's been a huge push to strengthen alignment. I think a lot of the budget reform, and we're quite admired internationally for our budget reform, has around been around that. The program budgets and the outcome orientation that comes from the 1998 PFMA, 3-year budgets, the Minister's Committee on the Budget, and the whole medium-term expenditure committee. So there is a very significant bureaucracy also working year by year to try and do this alignment, getting better value for money. I just mentioned in there that we get strong, we perform strongly in the international transparency rankings. So the data we've got about our budgets are quite good, and that is an important thing for our people to be able to say, well, this is not aligned or this is aligned, if we don't have that information. And I think committee members have probably seen that Treasury now releases not only a publication but very detailed Excel sheets about the different function groups and things. So, you know, from the Treasury side, in one way, we've got a lot of data. Where we still got a bit of a problem is linking this to output data, that we can say, well, we gave you this, but look what you produced. It's not commensurate with the input. But that is internationally a very tricky thing, and we simply haven't been able to see very good systems that strongly link inputs to outputs, but I think that is what we're working on. I think members would also know about the amendments and the legislation around the role of Parliament in the budget and amendments. So I think that was also an effort to get a stronger oversight role over the budget, and clearly an area where we're in implementation mode. I think what happened over the last 2 years is both in 2015 and 2016, the Cabinet Lekgotla confirmed that prior to the normal budget process being run by the Treasury in terms of the PFMA, they also want what is called a front prioritization or mandating process, which looks again where we are economically, socially, our targets in terms of our plans, and then how we can relate that stronger to the budget. So the budget really, and Treasury always ask for that assistance, so that government and the executive tells us quite clearly in the coming period what are the key priorities. So this is something we're busy with at the moment for the second year, trying to, in the current context, further distill the priorities and then relate that to the budget. And that's really where we are, starting to institutionalize such a process. So it is a bit premature to give strong conclusions from that process, because I mean, last year we went through a process and made certain recommendations to the Cabinet Lekgotla. This year we are busy with it again. But I think, and this is, you could call it a consultation with the committee, when we look at prioritization, we say we must, in a sense, agree what is prioritization. And we've identified these four really questions that we need to ask when we prioritize. The first one hasn't got so much directly to do with budgets, but it's the issue with, have we got the right approach, or are there key policy decisions that are outstanding? And the argument was, in a sense, is it doesn't help we allocate another billion to something, but it's a totally wrong-headed policy that we have. So really there are some of these key areas where before we go in and allocate more money, we've got to say, no, but this has got to be done in a different way. And some of the things we're thinking about here is road infrastructure and tolling. So there's this uncertainty about how we're going to go forward with tolling. If we don't go forward with tolling, there's a huge additional hit on the budget that must come from tax money. So while that uncertainty is there, you know, it's very difficult to budget. Another area is, for example, the broadband allocation and the ICT strategy. This is an area which is fundamental to our growth, to the growth of developing countries. But there's been big uncertainty around this. There's actually been money for digital transfer and all kinds of things in the budget, but it gets unspent because the policy area is not sorted out. So we think that from our perspective, before we go in and ask detailed questions about sense here and sense there, where there are these clear areas where things are not right, you know, we've got to say, you know, budget allocations are not going to help a lot if we don't sort out these policy areas. The second area, of course, is then, are we spending efficiently? So prioritization cannot only be about how much we give to each area, but it's also about how effectively people use it. Are there areas where we can save or improve value for money? And I mentioned three examples here, but they can be multiplied. I think we find a sense, for example, from the National Planning Commissioners, that they know how important basic education is, and that's a critical thing, but they are impatient with the quality of the outputs that we get for the money that we spend. So people say, yes, you know, we want to do good by education, but are you really using the money wisely? Are you checking on teacher and learner attendance and so on? So these are some of the broad areas. I think universities and skills funding, government has pushed significantly, the society has pushed significantly more money to universities, and people realized we had to do that. We've got to safeguard the sector. It's a very important generator of economic growth. But the question is, can't you do a bit better? You know, why must so many students fail and so on? So we think in the prioritization process, it's critical to interrogate these things as well. Our procurement also, how efficient it is and so on. Now, in some sense, the problem is that these things are not that straightforward always. Asking what the exact inefficiencies are in education and how we fix them is quite difficult. Tabu and myself have spent a lot of time on this issue. Is there a specific lever that you can change to change things? But these are complex sectors, and it is not as always that easy. Some people would say it's to do with monitoring systems that are not there, your annual national assessments. Others would say, well, it's the motivation of teachers, you know, and that is a very big problem. So year after year, I think we've been trying, and I think the Treasury has been pushing on this efficiency as well. We've got, Treasury does sort of expenditure reviews over the last 3 years. In DPME, we do the evaluations of different areas of work, and we look at intensively at those in order to see, you know, what are the areas where we can advise departments. And at any rate, that has been the second area that we include in our prioritization exercise. The third one, and this is really part of efficiency, but it is the important thing of focusing on transformation. So we've got these huge expenditures. Are there ways in which we can spend the money in a more transformative way? I think a lot of us struggle, but we also get criticized for doing that, but a lot of us struggle with our spending on human settlements and transport subsidies, which basically go into replicating the apartheid spatial structure. People drive far with buses in the morning to get to work. You know, our cities, the geography of our cities do not get transformed by getting workers closer to work and so on. So those are the types of areas where we're also interrogating departments. And the second one there is the area of procurement, where it is felt that, you know, much our procurement budget can be more efficiently used in not just being stuck in old supply chains where people used to buy things from certain people and they just continue it, whether it's coal or stationery and so on. But we've got to make sure that we're not trapped in these linkages and sectors that are really relics from the past. Have we done enough to break some of those relics, and how do we help entrepreneurs and new business people into those supply chains? So it's in a sense the issue of supplier development. It's not just good enough to say that those people can do it. We know why they can do it, because they've been doing it for 50 years. and so on, but we must also get new people in there. So it's about really developing the supply chain and developing new suppliers, making sure that we're not just captive to sort of old economic structures. So I think that's part of the structural structures that get entrenched, certain supply chains and so on. and which really just is based on the on history and not really on efficiency or anything like that. And I think the last thing then is what people see as probably normally the most important part of prioritization. Are we spending enough on the important things? And I think there also we're not exhaustive here because it's a difficult exercise. And in the budget process, it's quite problematic because everybody comes and say, well, our costs are increasing like this and we need more, you know. So it's a difficult area to work with, but we do think that there are some areas that are clearly at this stage underfunded in terms of, you know, what we need to do. And one area that I would think is critical is the area of technical and vocational education and training, because over the last number of years, as we've tried to stabilize the post-secondary education training sector, and it's mostly gone to universities, and clearly the big growth need is in the TVET sector. So that's an example of an area where we think things are not properly funded, and we also think around early childhood development, which is a very multidisciplinary thing, around health, but also early learning and social protection, that there are areas there that we will need to spend more if we want children to do better eventually in school and so on. So those are examples. It's not exhaustive, but we think they are some of the critical areas. But this is basically trying to answer these four questions in more detail over the next 3 months so that we're ready to advise on budget 2018. So I think from the broad numbers, we think with the funds available, we couldn't have done a lot different, but it is an ongoing process which needs to be sharpened every year. Thanks.
Members here, you, I don't see you struggling. There are figures.
You pushed into all the
numbers. And you know, you can see things are linked, you know, your budget, your programs, and also you can actually see the priority, government's priorities, and how the budget is also linked to government's priorities. I will now open for a discussion. Honourable members must reflect on the presentation, think and think deep, and then engage. Honourable members, Nukwanyana, number one. Dr. Fick. Honourable member, Sangweni. Dr. Madopa. All right, in that order. I saw it, or maybe you were scratching it. So I thought your head was up. Okay. All right, in that order.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I think maybe let me start by just commenting to say that I think we are in serious trouble in terms of the NGP targets and achieving them, not out of our doing, but because of the situation in the country. Just looking at the two apex priorities that we are looking at, just from the beginning, we are really not able to get there in terms of poverty eradication and reducing inequality, which are the core areas that we need to address. One other thing that you've actually sort of answered it, the issue of the reduction or the declining budgets for agriculture and land reform. I think you did, to a certain extent, answer it by mentioning the fact that you are not vetted as to what, but I do want to raise my concern that on one hand, we are saying that, you know, agriculture is the way to go. And there we are reducing the budget. In as much as we understand what the you know, the economic situation is in the country, I'm just wondering why then go for an era where we believe that it can help us improve our economy, even though we know also that there are difficulties in the agricultural sector. You know, earlier this morning when we were also talking about it, just one thing that I just didn't raise it, but I wanted to say that agriculture is the way to grow, but one area that I've always wondered about is how much support are we giving to the people? We expect them to actually implement agricultural programs and, you know, and even with the land reform, you find that people get compensation for land, and somewhere you even mentioned that, I'm just taking it further now, even mentioned that in this morning's presentation that people are encouraged to take land rather than financial compensation. I was sitting and thinking here as to what are they going to do with it, because a lot of people grew up in the urban area, in the township, they know absolutely nothing. And we've got living examples of people who have taken land instead of financial compensation, but they don't know what to do with it. So I just wanted to say that perhaps we need to find a mechanism whereby we can support these people, teach them about the agriculture, because they don't know how to go about in terms of agriculture, so that they can actually benefit from the land, because there's no point in having a land that you just cannot even utilize. I think I will just, I will end there. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Honourable Chairperson. Just a few comments or clarifying seeking questions from my side. On this slide number 5, while this figure comes up, it's been coming up from 2013, where NDP states that 11 million jobs are created. But what we don't see is these jobs, are they EPWP jobs? Are they short-term jobs? Are they long-term jobs? Are they skilled jobs? Are they unskilled jobs? Because it's going to make a substantial difference if somebody gets a job just for the sake of being there. So could we just get some sort of, if there is more information on that. Slide number 10 deals with the it's a known fact that in order for an economy to grow, you need skills, so you need a skilled workforce. Now, in order to have a skilled workforce, you need skilled facilitators and skilled teachers. What do you call them now? They call something else now. Anyway, teachers. Educated, that's correct. Thank you. I need to be politically correct. So my question on this is that, do we know whether we have skilled educators in order to ensure that we have a skilled workforce? Do we have those resources? Not only the financial, but the human resources, because I don't see that. Slide number 15. Now, this is the one that concerns me. That table on slide number 15 talks about the increasing at a decreasing rate, the expenditure. That tells me, and that's the way I understand it, is that if that is the case, then you'd have to borrow less, because now you are decreasing your expenditure. So if you're borrowing less, why then is your debt service cost continuing to increase? I didn't hear that. Somebody's talking about. Okay, and then lastly, Honorable Chairperson, this slide number 19 concerns me, for two reasons. The, on the one side, we look at the target of 2.8 million jobs by now and 2 million actual achieved. Now we say it's not bad because of reasons given our labor force's increase. A question that I would like to ask there is, did we, when that targets were set, was there the factor of your growth in population? Is that also something that we looked at? Because obviously we say there's a reason, it's because of our labor force, but what has caused that labor force increase? Is it possibly your increase in your population, which is more faster than if we have a target? And I'm not saying that there must be a target for population growth, because I might be trampling on the wrong toes, but one needs to look at that. The other reason that, Honorable Chair, I'm nearly done, is this question of that we don't have information, it concerns me. Specifically in this case, on that same slide, prosperity and equality. And I wonder if it's not because the figures are so bad that we don't get them. These are figures that don't have to be audited. I understand if it's financial information, but that is a concern. I notice we rely on the JSE, we rely on who's these people, Stats SA. Now, most of us use Google, and Google seems to be quite reliable, so is there not other sources of information? It just concerns me, because how do you plan, monitor, and evaluate them if you don't have the necessary stats? So perhaps we need to either have our own researchers and not rely on other researchers. Thanks, Honorable Chair.
Thanks, Chair. On page 3, on the business continues to be dominated by white male management. If we look at that statement, in which it can be true, but as well, if you look at the top 10 richest persons in South Africa, no woman reflects on that top 10. If you look at, so I think our emphasis should not only be on male counterpart, but also on women, because in the top 10 richest persons in South Africa, no woman is reflecting on that figure. And yet again, on the property ownership, and I fully agree with you there, how do you sort of translate the high transfer costs in this property ownership? How do you sort of incorporate or regulate that aspect? Because it can be that we want to buy property and people want to buy properties, but the high transfer costs sort of have a negative impact on ownership of property. And then on page 20, refinement of the role of Parliament in the budget, Parliamentary Budget Office. By when and when will this be done? Because one would have expected that alignment would have been done by now, that the Parliamentary Budget Office perfectly knows what they must be doing and they mandate as to their office. And then on page 21 on early childhood development, I've asked this question before. I can't recall, but it was in this committee. But wouldn't you think that this component should sort of be under basic education rather than social development? Wouldn't that be better aligning that component? Because now you have early childhood development that is a part in social development, and it's actually, for me, a function on basic education. So what is your take on that one? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Honorable Chair, and thanks to the presenter. I think the speakers assisted a lot, especially around the issue of the target and so on, to know what we have achieved on this one. But I want to check, because when you posed the question, one was of the view that maybe you will share with us as the people that are doing monitoring of how things are happening, especially around the issue of the education. You talk about basic education universities and procurement. We are asking a question whether it's the problem of the policy or it needs a policy or it's the approach, the way we do things. I was going to ask the question because what is important for us, because when we recommend the budget as this particular committee, we look at how people are spending. Maybe it was going to be of great assistance if you were indicating to say that when you look at how the universities are spending the money, maybe we are supposed to do this, like doing recommendation, because you see how things are going, because there is a growing concern around this, the expenditure in the universities, to say that they are not really spending on the real service delivery. Sometimes they spend most on the research, you know, going overseas, doing research, you know, which is not contributing to the development of the students per se. So maybe you can assist us to focus, to answer these questions yourself, so that you can assist us when we call the those departments or institutions. We are in a position to understand how do they function and spend the money, because we are more interested in the money, as the chair was indicating that we are following the money going forward. But we appreciate that you indicated this is the target. But I'm not sure. I know that the IDP talks about 11 million jobs that must be created. But I don't know about the breakdown in this particular year to say that this is the focus that we need to achieve, so that when we do our oversight, we can see whether we are really doing well or we are going backwards around the issue of the implementation. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. John will do the most difficult one. The ECD part, it has been a contested area, because there is also the view that if we take ECD into basic education only knows how to do teaching. So we are going to end up with learners who are still at 3 years, 4 years, actually being taught 1 + 1 = 2, instead of dealing with stimulation. And so the view has been that at that level of ECD, we need to have learners who are being stimulated, and that is why it should remain with DSD. The evaluation that we did on ECD suggested that actually we should move it away from DBE and DSD to have an independent entity that looks after issues of ECD, because it's the first 1,000 days of life are important. It's not just the ECD. It's when at conception, how the parents are looked after, whether they go for, I don't know, the immunization and the eating correctly, not those things are helping in the brains of the child, that when they are born, they are already advantaged or disadvantaged. When they are born, if they are not stimulated enough, provided with nutrition, correct nutrition, it also further disadvantages them, that by the time they reach grade R, there is more work in terms of trying to increase, recover for them to be able to catch up. Now, DBE and DSD have been throwing this for a long time, and we've been trying to say there must be a middle ground, of, especially since we're saying that there's a need for your 2 years of grade R, which we have not yet established. We've only done grade R, and our evaluation has shown that grade R, is the quality is still so bad that it's not adding advantage. And so the emphasis we've been emphasizing is that we need to improve how we do the quality of grade R, and then at DSD to say access is still an important issue. There are lots of children. We have not reached universal access on ECD. So that means we are further contributing to the disadvantage of the learners who are not stimulated and supported. And then on the issue of the procurement, I mean, it includes the issues of insourcing, that when we insourced, when universities insourced, it increased their cost quite dramatically because they were able to take out those costs outside. Now they have to internalize those costs, and this is having an impact on how the issues of funding are becoming much more difficult for universities as they try to deal with the pressure that they have been experiencing from the students. I'll leave the rest then to John.
Thanks. I think on the issue of agricultural and rural development, I'm not going to try to respond to that. I think we all know there are significant problems, but we'll have to bring our outcomes facilitator for that area to you, who's got an intimate deep knowledge of, you know, those budgets and also the constraints there. So I think the committee should indicate if you want a more detailed input from our people on agriculture. As I said, that is also an issue that the National Planning Commission is raising with us, so we look at it in more depth, but I'm not adequately enough informed to talk to that. I think about the jobs, what types of jobs? Indeed, there were some projections done for the NDP, and I don't know whether this slide is going to work. So what I can say is that on page, it's a table that is a bit difficult to summarize in the NDP, but on page 121, there are three scenarios in terms of growth rates. There's a sort of mediocre minerals, solid minerals, and then the diversified economy. And the diversified economy is really what the NDP shoots for. And in that program, there's about 500,000 jobs in the EPWP. And then an unemployment rate without the expanded public works program of 7.7%. So the NDP did in the, shall we call it, the optimistic scenario, did factor in expanded public works. And of course, if we've got slower growth, if growth is below 5.4%, the assumption was that more jobs would have to be in the EPWP. So for example, on a 3.3% growth, it was estimated that there's about 5.5 million jobs necessary in the expanded public work. So in that table, there's a sectoral breakdown of where it was believed the jobs can be created. And for example, in the diversified economy, the sense was that there would have to be about 5 million jobs in the informal sector. So both the expanded public works and the informal sector played a significant role in hitting those targets. the question of we need educators to get to skills. I mean, I thought Thabo would relieve me on that question as well. I think then there's the issue of why are we not borrowing less. I think the problem you've got if you, while you've got slower economic growth, revenues are not growing, if you also then in that area want to reduce your borrowing significantly, then you really squeeze spending. So normally what you found is that the deficit would go up during the slower economic growth. So it's a way of softening the blow. The question was when the targets were set, did we look at the population? And yes, in these job creation and scenarios, population growth was factored in and there were detailed projections. The problem is, of course, that it was done just before the 2011 census, and the 2011 census seems to tell us that around the 2008-99 we had a significant acceleration in births, so that the NDP actually underestimated the population growth to a significant extent, and that is then part of this explanation. We've nearly hit the employment target to 2015, but the unemployment went up. So the demography is an important issue that we factor in, and there's continual work with Stats SA around that. Why don't we have the numbers? Can't we Google the numbers? You know, if Stats SA doesn't have a poverty number, then really the world doesn't have a poverty, because they're the only people that really do broad representative survey of the population that can tell us that. So it's the census and then the living conditions survey and so on. There are smaller surveys like the National Income Dynamics Survey, but you know, it's more difficult to work with those numbers also disaggregated. So there are some checks with the NIDS, but the NIDS also takes, you know, 9 months to 18 months really to get their data out. So with reliable poverty figures and income distribution, you really rely on the Stats SA surveys. I think they've been a bit delayed on the living conditions survey. Normally it wouldn't be 18 months, 2 years. It's normally a bit slower, so I think there are difficulties because there was the census and the difficulty with the sample sizes and so on. So it's a bit of a long duration, but really, you know, the reality is if Stats SA doesn't do these things and do them quickly, nobody else has got detailed enough information to do these kind of things. So, I mean, Stats SA last week told me that these numbers will be available in May. They're releasing the living conditions survey again in May. So then we'll have an update to the end of 2015 on poverty. The issue of women in management, I think that is important. I'm not going to say more about that. I think we agreed on that. The obstacles to property ownership, I think, is a complex issue that, you know, I cannot really talk about. I mean, what we are also thinking is about traditional properties, but where we see most development is also in our cities. And it seems giving previously disenfranchised people part of that huge growth that is taking place in our cities is another area of property ownership we need to look at. You know, the Parliamentary Budget Office is operating. I think the Act empowering Parliament to amend the laws, those are in place, but I think as the Chair also suggested, I mean, it's in a phase where people are seeing where can this go, waiting for clear recommendations, but also, so I wasn't saying that there's sort of policy that needs to be finalised. The policy's been finalised, the PBO is in place, but we need, I mean, we're waiting to see how Parliament is really going to execute that role. I think, you know, I think we acknowledge that, you know, we would want in future to come with stronger recommendations. I think for the example of education, and there's not too much going on, research was mentioned. I mean, there's one sort of narrative really that says government has been badly underfunding basic secondary education, especially, you know, not secondary, post-secondary education, especially universities. My reading of the numbers is that is not true. It's a sector where government has pushed a lot of money in So the real spending on students has really kept track. What has happened is that the costs in the sector have increased very highly. And we don't see that it's all waste. It is an expensive sector. You've got to compete for highly skilled people. You know, you have to have the research projects and so on. But we do feel there people are perhaps misdiagnosing the problem. So this is a sector where costs can grow very quickly if you don't keep your hand on it, and we'll have to look at that. But I think in all these areas, you know, hopefully over the next 3 months we'll develop more specific recommendations. Yeah, and I think the last question was also the what jobs, the 11 million jobs. So the NDP has got a more detailed projection, but really with the shifts in the population numbers and also the changes in the international economy, we really need to revisit these job scenarios that were done for the NDP. So there, unfortunately, we are a bit behind, and it's urgent work to do. Thanks.
Chair, on the issue of qualifications, for the practitioners at grade R, we still have lots of them without qualification. So it's still a challenge. But between grade 1 to grade 12, we have most of our teachers qualified. There are still pockets where they're still struggling, but mostly our teachers are highly qualified. The challenge is that, which SATMEC is showing, is that even though our teachers are so highly qualified, they are unable to perform as those teachers who are not as highly qualified in among our neighbors. And SATMEC is showing it much, much more clearly that there is issue of productivity that we need to talk about. Going to universities, we have the lecturers that are qualified, but most of them are older lecturers who soon will be retiring. So we have a problem with our production of knowledge, because to produce a PhD, you need to be supervised by a PhD. And this is causing us a problem in terms of saying the sustainability. If we don't invest in creating new graduates, especially among the applicants who have other responsibilities and find academic work not to be appealing for them to spend so much time trying to get a PhD, if we don't intervene to support them to go into the PhD, we are more likely to lose the edge that we have in terms of production of new knowledge. Where we are really struggling is in the TVET, because for the TVET, you need someone whose skills to teach your engineering courses. But if that person is qualified, he'd rather go to a private sector, so they don't stay very, very long within the TVET. And so this is the challenge that we have. How do we reproduce, but still at the same time be able to retain the skills that they have? And also there we are having lots of artisans who are getting older. These are the white artisans who soon will be leaving the system, and this is going to affect how we produce the artisans that we need in the country.
Are there any follow-up questions? Honorable Member Imam?
Okay, I'm not sure if mine is a follow-up because I was out with some urgent business. So I'm just, but I have some questions. You know, when we identified the objectives, can you tell us what criteria we used? Did we take into consideration the growth rate, which might affect many other aspects, you know, in the volatile labor market, the health issues, the economic situation worldwide, in being able to, you know, achieve these objectives? So that's my one question. If you take specifically the issue of education, and yes, I think we all agree that we have serious challenges in terms of the Tivat colleges. It's really, it's not working, to be honest with you. I think, what was the success rate? 1 in 10, from what the statistics we have. I want to really know, what is your view, or how do you identify free education? Because, you know, many people have got many views about what is free education. So I want to know what is free, about free education, and to what extent. And not forgetting that one of the serious challenges we have in terms of the education, whilst I agree a lot of money is being spent on education, issues like NSFAS is a mess. It's absolutely, I mean, what are we collecting? 12% of what we give out. So it's not sustainable, because you just, you know, you rather not call it a loan anymore, because you're just giving and getting nothing in return. So it's very badly managed. And yes, maybe if that is managed properly, and what do you think is the way forward in being able to manage that forward? So you'd have more money to actually put back in there, because people that are now earning must be able to pay back, like we've seen when we went to Germany and Sweden. In fact, we were surprised, almost everybody pays back. There's no problem. It's only here there seems to be a culture of non-payment. How do we address that so that we can, you know, make it more effective and more beneficial to all the other things?
I think on what criteria were used for setting the targets and what was taken into account, I think it's a more general problem that in the planning department and the planning section of, we know our modeling is inadequate. You know, we've got to work harder in getting more comprehensive models of our economy and society. Really, as I said, there was a set of demographic projections that looked at what can happen to the population, and then there were also labour market simulations done which looked at the different factors that could impact on investment and savings and so on, and that how that would affect. So there was really a sectoral projection of the employment targets, and a lot was done around that. So what rate of growth do we need to get so many jobs in different sectors? So they recall at that stage the employment scenarios, which was really the heart of the economic projection being done there. So there was some systematic work trying to take into account as many factors, but I think what our minister is also pushing us now on very much is our tools for planning, and saying that essay is telling us we've got a social accounting matrix and a model that sits on top of that. Why are you not using that? So I think, you know, there are many things to do in terms of institutionalizing the planning, but we realize that there's a real challenge there. But some of these models were used. I think the issue of post-secondary education and training is contentious. I think one simple answer is that it can never be free. Somebody must pay for it. And what really worked, you referred to Germany. So in some countries, students will pay through loans later in their life. And if you don't pay it back through repaying loans, you'll have to pay more tax one day, because, you know, somebody's got to pay the taxes. So in that sense, there's a system. It's not who's going to pay, but it is when are you going to pay. Are you going to pay your parents while you're a student, or are you going to pay a loan when you start working, or are you going to pay a tax when you're already working? So I think that is the one perspective on that. But I think one doesn't want to preempt, and there's no decision in government or even in departments. But my sense is that we underestimate that there are very efficient higher education systems in where the students don't pay fees directly when they go to university, such as in the Nordic countries. And how do they do it? It's not magic. They tax people higher once they start working. And so I think there is a bit of a, in the current debate, where people don't look at this mix that, you know, we don't get anything for free. And it's really about how we fund it in an efficient way. And I think there you're very correct. I think we did the right thing with the National Student Financial Aid Scheme. Such loan schemes are sort of the, shall we say, the bedrock of the UK higher education system, of the Australian higher education system, where you've got an efficient loan system funding students. And yeah, so we've got to, we did the right thing with the NSFAS, and I think it's a bit of a symptom with most of our SOEs and state boards that somehow things got out of hand. But the important thing is not to try and get another miracle. We've just got to sort out the
international financial aid scheme, and, well, as an interim step at least, and strengthen that significantly. And I think there were mixed messages about repayment and about loans versus bursaries and so on, and I think that's where we've got to get the policy quite right as well.
Sorry, Chair, can I have a follow-up? Thank you, Chair. This growth rate that we're talking about, and I find that we always seem to be, when we talk about a growth rate, we always overestimate it. It's, you know, much higher than what we're really achieving. And that's where my concern is, how does it impact on being able to achieve these objectives if we are always going to be giving a high estimated growth rate, knowing that we're not really, you know, coming anywhere close to that. And that's for me a serious problem. And the other thing is you said there was 2 million jobs. I just wanted to know, is that permanent jobs, or is it permanent including this EPW works jobs, or is it, you know, you could just...
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm in dangerous terrain here because I'm actually the more of a social policy person. So if Rudy hears that I'm talking about growth rates, he's going to... but I think, you know, what we've done in the early years, we underestimated growth rates and quite often overshot on tax, so on. So I don't think we're always overestimating, but surely at this stage we've fallen behind what we hoped for. But, you know, there were quite a few international developments, local developments. So I don't think, you know, if there's a particular sickness in the, I think the NDP, you want to be a bit optimistic because you also want to push a country. So we might have been a bit optimistic, but clearly there's a need to remodel, recalibrate here. And I haven't got the specific numbers, but certainly in the projection there were some EPW jobs, PW jobs included, depending on the scenario, and they were clearly not permanent. But, you know, the target did include significant permanent jobs as well in the different sectors. Yeah. I don't know whether that answers your questions, but...
I think we need more figures in terms of this as to how many permanent jobs, because temporary jobs, you know, in that report that they're going to give us image.
Thanks, Chair. I think from our side, we just want to say thanks for inviting us, and we hope it's a relationship that will be built from now to be much more stronger. And we are promising to return to you with the reports of the 14 outcomes, which gives you the details of where we are, what were the targets, and whether we've achieved and why we have not achieved those targets. So we'll give you that report on that, and then if it is possible, we will, if the committee so wants, we would like to bring the other outcomes facilitators so that they will be able to answer the all 14 questions or from each sector, so that we give you more detailed information rather than an overall information, which I believe will help you going forward in terms of your work. We just request that if we need to be able to give the information on why some of these things have not been achieved, we will not be able to do it tomorrow. So we will ask some time to be able to at least give you also the information on why those targets were not met as part of the submission that we wish to make to you. Overall, we say thanks, and we hope we've been able to dug ourselves out of the hole that we were in.
Thank you so much. Well, in closing, I'd like to thank the honorable members for coming to this meeting fully prepared and for the robust engagement. I would also like to thank you for indeed responding to our invite. For responding to our invite, but also for the two presentations that you have presented to the committee. We regard these presentations as critical presentations and also critical sharing of information from the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation on the mid-term progress of the MTSF and the alignment between the budget priorities, the MTSF and the NDP. Just to give highlights of the key issues that came out from our engagement. One, as we agreed, the committee will need more detailed information on the actual progress on the NDP targets and the MTSF, and we'll await for that information that we have agreed upon. As we expect you to give us a report on progress made to date, we also expect you to tell us about the bottlenecks and how you think those bottlenecks could be addressed. We need a report on areas where teachers are still teaching without qualifications, as you have alluded to. But if I'm correct, you referred to teachers at the ECD level and grade R level. Okay. We also need a report on areas where teachers... Okay, sorry, I've done this one. Well, as the committee, we expect a lot more support from critical departments such as yourself. Oversight is only effective when informed by well-timed data and information so that we hold state entities accountable and are relevant in our engagement. Part of this committee's responsibility is to assist you to do an excellent job, but we also expect you to empower us. Hence, we will appreciate any useful reports from your department, reports that we will use as a yardstick to measure performance from the department. Close monitoring of progress towards the achievement of the NDP is essential and cannot be overemphasized. Well, to the I think I'm correct in saying that 2030 is not as far as it sounds. We are only left with 13 years. So if we do our best in this term, at least we will be able in the next term to bank on those who will be involved in the next term to take this to another level. So to us it's very important that we implement the programs for this term to the latter and have quality impact. because whether we want, there is a budget. I know there was some, I would say, actually I put here, it's like we're complaining about reduction of the expenditure budget. In any situation, whenever you are required to adjust, you will do that. Now, with the economic meltdown, government found itself having to adjust by lowering the budget ceiling. And what was expected also with your good self, when you analyze the APPs, the departments and APPs, you must also emphasize that. What is expected is that then department will be expected to also adjust. They can't expect to operate with the initial budget, regardless of the budget, that the budget ceilings that have been reduced. Does it make sense? Mm-hmm. Hey, everybody. You see, if, for instance, I grow big, say, I will buy bigger clothes. But when I go down, even yourself, you know, you also go and buy smaller sizes. Yeah, you can go to the tailor, or you go and buy smaller sizes, because now you can only fit in the smaller size. If you don't go with a big, you'll be such a laughing stock. I'm trying to say, let's be practical. Where National Treasury pronounced reduction of budget ceiling, I'm sure you will also send that message to the department. They are also expected to adjust according to those ceilings and not to fight amongst themselves for the limited resources, but they adjust and look at what can be implemented with the budget that they have been given, living within their means and not above their means. Our observation is seen departments spending more than they have, spending money they didn't have. In terms of the budget principle, you can't spend money you don't have. You can't. But we've seen it happening. It happened because people did not realize that they are called upon to reduce, to adapt to the limited resources that they were allocated. And also some, I don't know how we can, but at your planning level, I'm sure you can also introduce the culture of compromise. Compromise where there's no budget, and then you look at which department can be allowed to, you know, and compromise for that year, because it is a situational matter that would need to be addressed. Like, for instance, education. In education, you can't reduce the budget. Maybe you can reduce in the other departments. But not education. This whole nation can come to a standstill. And you, in your presentation, you have emphasized that without education, this nation will collapse. So this is the compromise I'm talking about. To say, that times when you're called upon to compromise. We've seen it with Germany and Berlin, where the Germany compromised to uplift Berlin. Those people said, you know, we have money, but we have to compromise and assist Berlin and stop with other things, assist Berlin and bring it up to the same level with us. Am I talking about something that you're familiar with? That's the type of compromise. I think we don't have it. I don't know what will it take for us to learn and also see the need to compromise so that some programs, whether we want or not, cannot be compromised. They must be supported at all costs, at all costs. Talking education, health, talking life, health, education, nation building, development of the country. So I think these are things that you will have to raise when think, when you engage with the department. Now, to share with you, we have decided that this, in this financial year, the program that we are going to elevate, and it will be our apex priority, is infrastructure development. And we have correctly agreed on that one, because we see that one as prescribed by your MPP as one pillar that can assist with the job creation. Of course, when you create jobs, then there's a potential of reduction of poverty, but also of inclusive economic growth. There's a big budget for infrastructure development. I'm talking an overall budget for the infrastructure development in the country. And the National Development Plan also is putting emphasis on infrastructure development. So we have not seen anything from your presentation. Maybe in your future presentation, if you can also look at that one, this budget. How is it assisting us to create jobs? Because there is a budget. And how is it going to assist us to create an inclusive economic growth? How far have we gone with that? And also poverty reduction. The more we promote inclusive economic growth, it came out from your presentation, the more we will also at least be able to deal with this inequality. So the answer, as we move towards 20, at least if we can make an impact in those areas. Job creation, inclusive economic growth in terms of the infrastructure development plan and the budget that has been made available, but also the poverty reduction. So that's I know you spoke about your priority and you spoke about the cabinet priority, this one area, because it cuts across all the departments. So if you can help us there, we will also give you our report, because we have requested all the departments to submit to us their infrastructure development plans. Because we can't just move from some parking. We have to move from what they have planned and then monitor it on a quarterly basis just to check on whether they're making an impact or not, and where they're not making an impact, they must explain to us on what is the bottleneck or what are the bottlenecks. So maybe in this financial year, if we can go strong there and get a response from the departments, I'm sure we will be able to make an impact in these three areas, prioritized areas by the NDP. But then, thank you so much for your participation. I'm sure you'll agree with me that we've had a fruitful and a meaningful engagement. So we will then meet you soon. Thank you very much. Honourable members, the meeting has been adjourned. I don't know.